Hi, welcome to the show. For the rich and the poor, investments outside of stocks are a good way to diversify your portfolio, be it with some real estate, corporate or government bonds, baseball collectibles, or even investments in art. And that's what I plan to talk about today. Economists David Chambers and Elroy Dimson and Christoph Spangiers developed a working paper titled Art Portfolios in order to better understand the long-run performance of art as a separate class of assets. Within their study, they did not randomly look at art portfolios, but studied the collection of a world-famous British economist, John Maynard Keynes. Now, who was Keynes? Well, he was one of the leading economists of the early 20th century. He was not only one of the most influential economists of his era, but was instrumental in putting together the Bretton Woods Agreement, which set monetary policy for the world after the Second World War. In addition to being a renowned and respected economist, though, he was also a terrific investor. And I will tell you that in spite of what you might think, being a great economist and a great investor do not necessarily go hand in hand. According to records, in the 18-year period encompassing the Great Depression and World War II, the investment fund he managed for King's College at Cambridge University grew fivefold, a remarkable performance given that the UK stock market fell 15% in the same period. His investment success carried over to his personal art collection as well. Through his abundant connections to the art world and insider tips from his artist friends, he was able to accumulate the right art pieces at the best prices and enjoy them for the rest of his life. And here's the investment angle. Keynes amassed a 135-piece art collection for under £13,000. That's about $16,000 at today's conversion rates. And by 2013, his art portfolio was valued at over £70 million. In case you're wondering, this translates into a compounded rate of return of 10.9%. So what does their analysis of Keynes' little slice of the art world inform us about the art market? Well, for starters, it tells us that investment returns of 10% over a long span of time can really add up to an awful lot of money. Secondly, by digging deeper and analyzing the performance of his art portfolio, it was found that his collection and the art market as a whole was structured very much like a lottery, with lots of participants but very, very few winners. This is why I say that art investing is like attempting to play for the NBA. Getting into the NBA is tough. Of over the 18,000 male students that play basketball in NCAA schools, only 44 are drafted into the NBA. Of the 135 works Keynes had accumulated, only a few showered him with enormous gains. In the meanwhile, the bulk of the other artists in his collection struggled to make any impact on the art world or the world of money, for that matter. Ironically, probably the only group to make their fortunes on these talented but unfortunate also-rans were really just the art dealers. Keynes' chance of success with his art portfolio was no different. Of the £70 million value of his entire collection, nearly £64 million of it was comprised of only 10 artists. Each of the 10 were worth, let's say, on average, £6.4 million each, compared to the remaining 125 artists' works valued at about £48,000. But what differentiated Keynes from other collectors was that he was smart about his purchases. He liked to buy good quality art at low prices, and he concentrated 80% of his spending into those 10 works. For example, he bought works by Van Dyck at auction when prices were low and acquired more paintings in Paris right after the end of World War I when the market was depressed. He also had friends who were extremely knowledgeable and had an inside track to the market. This enabled him to acquire the well-known artists of the day, such as Degas, Cézanne, and Picasso. My key takeaway is that investing in art only makes sense if you have a lot of wealth and you can buy only the marquee names, such as Picasso or Koons or Modigliani, just to name a few. Most importantly, you'll need to buy them at deep discounts, possibly during recessions or other economic slumps. And as far as slumps are concerned, the deeper, the better. Moreover, the art market is highly illiquid, meaning that if you really needed the money, you'll likely end up selling your artworks for significantly less than their true worth. Now, even though it is improving, it is hard to get good data about sales and prices in the art market. Therefore, I think most reasonable people would conclude that investing in art is very tricky and unlikely to deliver solid returns. And finally, unless you have an edge in this quirky market, I'd say putting much of your wealth here will not have the outcome you desire. So skip putting fine art in your diversification toolbox. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Life moves very fast these days. The days zip by, and some things are just pushed aside because, let's face it, they have to be. If it's not in your face and doesn't get your attention right away, all of us will put important things off. Except for some of us, especially when it comes to money, those things reappear when our heads hit the pillow at night. So I want to suggest an idea to you. I've decided to put on another roundtable event where I'm going to help you start focusing on the next stage of your life. I'll show you how to figure out if you'll have enough money to retire, or if you're retired, to figure out if it will be enough to last for the rest of your life. Maybe you want to leave some money behind, and maybe you don't, but how do you really know if the decisions you've made so far are adding up the way they should? And how will you know if the decisions you're making today will be the best for you and your family's future? And here's another thought. Wouldn't it be a shame if you had more than enough money to live the rest of your life the way you wanted to, but you didn't live that way because you were afraid of running out of money? Wouldn't it be a shame if you were holding on to your money too tightly out of fear and uncertainty? I'm going to be tackling these and other important topics at my next roundtable event, which will be at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura on Thursday, June 1st. We'll have two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which time works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. So Thursday, June 1st, at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Join me as we take the time to understand what your money truly means to you so you can get back to sleeping well and knowing that you've figured out how to live your one best financial life. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. Coming up, part two of my conversation with Money Magazine's Donna Rosato. Next.
We found that for folks, the change was really a time to do something that was more personally rewarding and interesting.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Donna Rosato is a senior writer at Money, where she writes about financial challenges facing retirees and strategies for career advancement. This is part two, where Donna and myself discuss Money Magazine's responses to readers' questions. Hey, Donna, welcome back for part two.
I am really glad to be talking with you again, Steve.
So let's get started. Question number one. I'm in my 50s. I got laid off a few months ago. What's the secret to landing a new job when you've been out of work a long time?
Well, that's a real issue for folks who are older. I mean, in the past year, we've seen a terrific rebound in the job market. But for people who are older, the long-term unemployed, who are out of work for 6 months or longer, the unemployment rate is 30%. Mm-hmm. And for folks who are over 55, it's 45% of those folks are still looking for work. So it's a serious problem. I think there is age discrimination out there. But there's this new report from the AARP Public Policy Institute that was based on interviewing folks who were older and landed new jobs. And we found some surprising strategies that older workers are using to get back into the workforce.
Yeah, that's great. So let's hear some of them.
So one of the things we found is that, you know, it's a good thing for you to try out a new occupation. you know, almost two-thirds of the re-employed older workers found jobs in an entirely new occupation. And that was true for women even more so than men. Of course, the traditional advice is that, hey, you kind of should stick with what you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we found that for folks that the change was really a time to do something that was more personally rewarding and interesting. And I think a lot of people, when they're looking at it sort of in your 50s, looking for that sort of second career, are looking for something less stressful,
mm-hmm.
and maybe fewer hours. So I think that's where some of the change comes from.
Yeah, but I think the point that you're making as well is to embrace change and not to resist it, right?
That's right. That's right. Don't be afraid, you know, don't be afraid to try a new venture. That was a strategy that worked for a lot of folks.
All right. So what was another strategy that people were using, those that were able to successfully get re-employed?
Well, you have to be aggressive. And I think this is probably true of all workers, but especially, you know, older re-employed workers, almost half of them, when they landed a new job, had contacted employers directly about the job. And that was because, you know, like you reapply for a job online, you don't know what happens to things. And
yeah, it's a black hole, right? You really want to get out there and beat the bushes and, you know, get the scuffs on your shoes, so to speak, and really start talking to everybody and contacting the jobs or the bosses directly. What about networking? You know, everybody tells you got to go out and network, but, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. What's the thinking on that?
Well, it was very interesting. Half of the people who landed a new job reach out to their network for leads, but only a third of them use personal contacts, like friends and mm-hmm. family. But here's where I think an older worker has an advantage. You want to reach out directly to people who are in the field of where you want to be. And I think older workers have those more valuable contacts. You know, it may be a waste of time to be talking to your neighbor or your friend mm-hmm. about what you want to do when you've got very good contacts. You've been working for a long time. Use those folks. Use professional contacts to find out about opportunities. Rely less on friends and family.
What about the use of social media? There's a lot of hype about LinkedIn. You must be on LinkedIn and Facebook. Were they very effective in getting new jobs?
This was a really interesting part of the report of the study, that about half of the people who got reemployed definitely found online job boards a good source of job leads. And that's because the job boards are really specific to the industry, not just general. But only 13% said online social media networks like LinkedIn and Facebook were effective in helping them get a job.
Yeah, so that was 13%, not a very high number.
No, and that's surprising. Everyone says use LinkedIn. But I think one of the reasons maybe is people may not know how to use LinkedIn.
Mm.
You have to constantly update your online resume. You need to really directly reach out to people. People aren't just going to find you mm-hmm. on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
You have to really know how to use it.
Mm. Good point. So here's another question. I want to find part-time work to bring in extra income when I retire next year, but I don't want to be a greeter at Walmart. How do I find a job that's meaningful but still flexible enough for me to enjoy my retirement life?
Well, it's a really interesting question because I think you know that most people say they don't want to stop working completely when they retire. Some people want to work beyond retirement age, but a lot of people say their ideal retirement is working, but they want to do a job that is fulfilling, but also flexible. So that is a little harder to find.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want something that's flexible, it may not be the thing that might be the most valued by an employer. Most employers want you to have your nose to the grindstone.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
So, yeah, and I think, you know, some people just want to bring in some income. Some people want to just do something different. But most people don't want to go from a professional career to something that's sort of mindless and boring.
What about the idea of, with your current employer, downshifting to part-time? Is that realistic?
You know, I've done a couple of pieces on, there's a traditional name for it called phased retirement, where you stay with your employer and you sort of ease into it, cutting mm-hmm. back your hours, maybe giving up some duties like, you know, managing people, and just kind of focusing on the core of what you do. And very few employers have formal programs, I think about 10%. But when I've interviewed people, I found lots of people who were able to kind of do this on an informal basis with their employer. Now, when you downshift, you know, you give up money. You know, you're not going to be able to work fewer hours and get the same pay. So you really have to run the numbers and see if that makes sense, but it does. I mean, you're a known quantity to your employer. You can still add value. And look, it can be a win-win for them if they have to pay you less.
You know, one of the answers to this question surprised me, and I'll just read part of it. Fill in at a high level for mid and higher level executives. Another option is to temp as an interim executive. So I didn't even realize that that was kind of an available profession and that there would be executive headhunters out there looking, you know, to fill those kinds of temporary positions for executives.
It really is out there, and it makes a lot of sense, right? Companies may be in between in hiring. They may only want someone while they're transitioning to something new or for specific projects with specific expertise. And it's a great opportunity if you really like that sort of prestige and the pace of executive life, but you want to do things project by project. So you sign up for 6 months, 3 months, maybe a year, and you've got that, but there's an end date to it. And I think you should look. There are places, for example, there's a group called the Riley, R-I-L-E-Y guide that lists firms that are specializing in placing interim executives. But I also encourage people to look at retiredbrains.com, which does focus on workers with a lot of experience and not always executive level, but very professional workers looking for project-based type work.
That's great information. And to hear this again, don't forget to join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org, where we will post the segment with Donna Rosato. Donna Rosato is with Money Magazine and writes about the financial challenges facing retirees and strategies for career advancement. We're running out of time here, but one that I did notice that I liked was to seek adventure. Check out coolworks.com's Older and Bolder section. It's aimed at retirees looking for seasonal or temporary jobs at national parks, lodges, ranches, and other outdoor destinations. Real quick, tell us about that.
I talked to a number of people who are doing that. If you really want to do something different and fun, you know, this is a really, really interesting, just really out of the box thing for you to do. I know a lot of couples do that together and they get to do some traveling. And you get to use your brain because usually you are giving information about the, you know, the park or the history of the place.
Yeah, so I think
the
bottom line is don't give up. Think bigger. Expand your world. Embrace change. And have some fun in this next part of your life. You may find it very rewarding. As I said before, my guest, Donna Rosato, senior writer at Money. She writes about financial challenges facing retirees, strategies for career advancement. And to find out more about Donna, and to hear this interview again, join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org. Once again, hey, Donna, that was a lot of fun. Thanks so much. We'll have you back.
Oh, thanks so much, Steve.
Coming up, your divorce judge may seem to agree with you, but he or she is thinking about something else entirely different. Stay tuned to find out what really goes on in the divorce courtroom.
They only hear the very relevant parts. They don't hear what a dirty scoundrel your soon-to-be ex is.
Do you have enough money to live the life you want to live? Do you have the resources to support you and your loved ones? And how do you know if you'll have enough to retire, or if you retired, how would you know if it will be enough to last the rest of your life? Well, that's exactly what my next roundtable event is going to be about. I'm going to answer these and other questions on Thursday, June 1st. I've even set up two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's Thursday, June 1st at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which one works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Here's a fact About 1 in 5 women fall into poverty as a result of divorce. About 1 in 3 women who own a home and have children at home lose their homes. Men can also experience difficulty as well. Most men experience a loss in their standard of living in the years after a divorce, a loss generally between 10 and 40% depending on circumstances. So, we're going to talk today about the financial impact of divorce and discover smarter ways to handle this particular life crisis. So, I've invited Angie Hallier, a practicing divorce lawyer and a certified family law specialist. She is AV-rated by Martindale Hubbell and authors a divorce education column, and she has a new book, The Wiser Divorce, Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life, where she lays out a better way to handle this important and possibly expensive life-changing decision. Really, Angie, it was a great book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. So glad to be talking to you.
You know, divorce is a life crisis in many ways. What is it about divorce that can create so much destruction and problems well into the future?
Well, you know, the number one thing is how people handle their emotions during the divorce. And we all know that divorce, you know, it gets a bad rap. It has this reputation for being a very expensive battle. And what makes it a very expensive battle when it is one is how people monitor their speaking, their actions, and their attitudes. And when they employ the right strategies for those things, it doesn't have to be a battle, and it doesn't have to be as expensive.
It used to be, I don't know, maybe even just 30 years ago, that in order to get a divorce, someone had to be at fault, and it was never spoken about in polite company, and it was kind of a shameful action. And, you know, the whole idea of divorce, though, has changed over the years. And you write in your book, I thought this was really quite interesting, that when it comes to getting married, the law treats us like grown-ups and trusts us to figure it out. But when it comes to divorce, the courts traditionally have the final say. How did it end up that way?
Well, you know, part of it is just the way people looked at divorce, again, as a battle. It's a lawsuit. And, you know, unfortunately, that's how you have to do it. Somebody has to sue somebody. Someone has to respond. And many times you ended up in front of the judge because the old mindset and the old mindset of attorneys was, you know, you go to court, you get your answers.
Mm-hmm.
So many things have changed today. There are so many different ways that people can go about ending this legal contract of marriage that don't require that.
So divorce, if it's a battleground that's going to be fought in the courts, someone's got to win and someone's got to lose, right?
Well, that's the myth. But that's not true. And one of the things we talk about in the book is how, you know, there really isn't a supreme commander of justice. People think if they go to court, they will be declared right, or they will get their revenge, or someone will just declare who's good and who's evil. And it's simply not the case. Judges are human like the rest of us. And when you trust your destiny in the hands of someone who may only see you for 3 hours
mm-hmm.
and who you're asking to decide the outcome of a 20-year marriage, you're not going to end up with what you want. And that's one of the key things to saving money in your divorce, is being smart about the process you use to end it.
You spend a chapter discussing the life of the average judge. You know, as laypeople, we may go to court and we think, you know, he's really listening to my side of the story and able to really express and, you know, maybe ranting and raving a little bit, but he'll get me because I've been so unjustly treated. But, you know, the judge is sitting there. Just give us a quick idea of what the judge's day might be like.
Right. So if you're a divorce judge, all day long, day in, day out, you see people come before you who are arguing about things that, you know what, grown-ups normally wouldn't argue about. Whether your child can be in soccer, who's going to get the $50 savings account, things that just to the outside world, you can't imagine they're being asked to decide. Intimate things about your life. Mm-hmm. Then that's not enough for them. They have a pile of paperwork where everybody is arguing back and forth and back and forth. So they become, you know, they get really jaded. And even if you come before them and they think, wow, you're really sympathetic, they're restrained by the law as to what they can order and what they can't order. So, you know, they have very little time. They only hear the very relevant parts. They don't hear what a dirty scoundrel your soon-to-be ex is. And they're human. So put that all together and you get, you know, maybe not the best outcome.
My guest is Angie Hallier. She is a practicing divorce lawyer and the author of The Wiser Divorce, Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life. I have read it. And I do recommend it if you're going through this situation or contemplating it. It's an important book to read. Angie, though, you talk about setting aside emotion. You know, that's so easy to say, but hard to do, especially if you feel that you've been shamed or something the spouse has done that has hurt your feelings. It's very, very hard to put those emotions aside. What can we actually do? What are some first steps that a person can take to start to pull themselves together so they have the right outcome?
So one of the things I suggest is that you envision your divorce as a series of rooms. Because what I want people to do is be able to come into the divorce room, that room where you're actually just ending that contract, and put their emotions in another room, because those emotions aren't going to go away. But when you mix up your rooms and walk around all the rooms while you're trying to divide your assets and debts, and talking about your children, that's when it gets confusing. So envision that when you're with your attorney, when you're making decisions about your financial future, you're not mixing it up with these other emotions, because you're going to have them. You know, the other thing I talk about is it really is like setting up a business. The matter of your divorce is a business. If you were starting a business, you would plan, you would execute, you would wisely spend your money, you would set goals. You need to do the same thing for that process of your divorce. The other thing is I mentioned using scripts. Training yourself to speak about your divorce in a certain way triggers your brain starting to think about it in a certain way. So I've got some advice in the book for using scripts as well. And then lastly, I mean, really sit down and do some worksheets about this. And we have that in the book as well. Think about what is the good you're going to take forward from your divorce, because I guarantee you there was some. Think about what things you never want to take forward that you had during your divorce. You know, what you didn't like that you're just going to lose and forget about. And then think about what those unfulfilled things are that you have inside you. Maybe it's time you wanted to spend with certain people you didn't, or experiences you want to have, and just focus on what that future can be, and that will really help.
I think a lot of people feel that settling in certain areas of the divorce, they're looking for a sense of fairness, and I'm going to give an example that you gave in the book. So often one party runs up a significant amount of debt without any consultation with the other spouse, so they just start using the credit cards and they build up debt. The spouse is perhaps unaware of it. And then in the divorce, the spouse has to assume his or her portion of the debt in divorce, and that just doesn't seem fair. Is achieving fairness truly the ultimate goal?
You know, you want people to be able to hold their head up when they're done and say, you know what, this was an outcome I can live with. But fair doesn't really exist in the law. Nothing is fair. I mean, if we go back, you think, hey, it was never fair. I fell in love with this guy or gal to begin with. So you need to change that thinking from fairness to what I can live with to gracefully end this marriage.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it's quite important to find the right attorney for this wiser divorce. How do you go about finding this person?
Right. And it's the right attorney for you, because, you know, there are a lot of good attorneys out there. It's just like doctors. There's great doctors. There's not so good doctors. The same with attorneys. You need to find an attorney that immediately puts you at ease and makes you feel that they have your back. You need to find the attorney who's in the right price range for you, because, you know, there's all hourly rates when you're looking at attorneys. If you have a simple case, you don't need the number one attorney in town. And if you have a very complicated case, you may need multiple attorneys working on your case. You have to consider all of those things. And for me, what makes the best attorney is what I think makes the best doctor. If you go to a doctor with a problem and they say, here's what you have, take this pill 5 times a week, come back and see me, you know, that's not really the best thing. You want a doctor that says, here's what I've identified you have. Here are the 4 options for treatment. Here is what you could expect from each option. And here is the option I recommend. And here's what you need to do your part in the treatment. That's what makes a good divorce attorney. So you need to look for someone like that.
My guest is Angie Hollier. She wrote The Wiser Divorce, Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life. Number 9 here is follow your attorney's advice. It's listed, follow your attorney's advice, follow your attorney's advice, follow your attorney's advice. What are you trying to say?
Follow your attorney's advice is kind of what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
But it is amazing. You know, people pay their attorneys all this money and they rely on them. And when they do not follow their attorney's advice, they're making a mistake because, you know, like me, I have been through thousands of divorces. I know how things you do now play out in the end. So even if it doesn't make sense to you now, listen to me.
We have about 2 minutes left, and I just want to get to some of the kind of the end thoughts here, because again, it's all in the book. But to you, Angie, what is a perfect divorce, and how would you achieve it in about a minute and a half?
Right. So the perfect divorce is one where you come out at the end of your divorce and you know what your plan is for the future. You know where you're going to go. You know how much money you have, and you haven't spent excess money you shouldn't spend during the process, and you have it to live your next best life.
Yeah. And that's really the key. It can turn into a financial nightmare, and you want to, like everything else in your life, start to take control of your finances. And in a situation where it can be so devastating when you're making these life choice decisions, by far, you want to be very careful and very smart when it comes to divorce. If this is going to be a win-lose situation, if you're going to go to court and rack up all these bills, you have to really think, what are we going to have left after this whole process is over and done with? What is left for me to live my one best life? My guest is Angie Hollier, and that is spelled H-A-L-L-I-E-R. And she can be found at AngieHollier.com. Angie, thank you so much for sharing your time.
Thank you, Steve, so much.
Terry Story and Real Estate Roundup is next.
Little boxes on the inside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the inside, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one. And they all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So I'm living in a home and I want to kind of figure out what I could do to the property to fix it up, maybe to get it ready for sale or also to enjoy, you know, that work that I needed done. What is the top return on an investment of that kind?
Sure. Well, according to the Appraisal Institute research, they find that you want to do smaller projects. For example, a limited kitchen redo. You don't want to rip out all the cabinets and new appliances. That's a big project, big undertaking. And especially if you're doing it to sell it, you might not even be picking the right kind of kitchen for what a buyer may want.
Oh.
So this, again, is really cost to value ratios that they're looking at. Now, they claim, and this again is nationally, invest in attic insulation. I guess that's something big up north.
Yeah.
Entry door replacements to steel doors if you have wood doors. Manufactured stone veneer. And again, a minor kitchen remodel. Garage door replacement and siding replacements. And the way I look at this, Steve, I can relate this to what we have here in South Florida. I'll give you an example. I have a house that totally needs to be gutted. And everybody that's coming to look at it, they're not afraid of redoing kitchens and baths, but what they don't want to get into is having to put on a new roof and impact hurricane windows.
Yeah.
Because that's not a fun cost. Nobody enjoys spending that kind of money to put those items on. They want to see.
It could be like $70,000,
$80,000. Well, it's a lot of money.
By the time.
Exactly. So, Steve, if you're going to spend $80,000, and again, if you're trying to resell your house, you're really better off putting the money towards like roof and impact windows because buyers don't want to spend the money on those items.
Yeah, I don't want to come in with a bad roof and know that I have that big expense ahead of me.
Yeah, you want to do it on the fun stuff. You want to spend the money so you can see the results of your new bathrooms and floors and so on and so forth.
Oh, really interesting.
So, you know, that's the difference.
Okay. All right, well, let's move on. So let's talk about some mistakes that retired people make when they're getting ready to sell their real estate or to look at, you know, transitioning into a new lifestyle. Tell us about that.
Well, first mistakes, it's holding off too long to make a move. Some people will just wait too long and then it's just not a good decision. You want to be able to do it while you're able to. Some ideas is to actually plan way ahead. Maybe when you're in your 30s or 40s, if you're able, buy something, rent it out, so that by the time you are ready to retire, it's already paid for. You've got tapping into retirement funds to pay off a mortgage. Ideally, retirees should head into retirement debt-free. You don't want to carry a mortgage with you, if at all possible.
Yeah, but I think you have to be very, very careful because your retirement funds can represent your basic nest egg. And as a financial planner, I can tell you that this idea of taking a modest nest egg and taking a lot of it and putting it into a mortgage is really a huge mistake. And I'm going to take a minute and tell you why. First of all, you are burying this money. If it's now illiquid, you put it into your house, you would have to actually get a loan to kind of borrow it back out if you wanted to. Number one, if you could actually get a, you know, home equity line of credit or something like that. So you're remortgaging anyway. That's number one. Number two, you know, you know, need your nest egg to pay for your lifestyle. Your nest egg is going to produce a certain amount of income, plus you're going to be chipping away a little bit at the principal in order for you to live the life that you want to live. And if it's all buried in the house, it's inert. The money becomes inert, and it's a big, you know, a big risk to you. So the bottom line is, if you have the resources, you have plenty of money, you have over enough money for retirement, yeah, paying off your mortgage is fine, but not if you have limited resources.
That's right. And I'm dealing with this right now with an elderly couple, and I know it's a big mistake. But here's another common one, deeding the property to your children. And again, everyone needs to be talking to their financial advisor. So you may be encountering unnecessary tax bills, and you may also be missing out on that $250,000 capital gain tax exclusion.
Yeah.
If you're single, or $500,000 if you're married.
Good point. So you get the first $250,000 of gain is not taxed. And if you're a couple, it's $500,000. So you don't want to give up that tax benefit.
Right. So those are the mistakes, slip-ups that can occur, and you just want to try to avoid them.
I guess the bottom line is, you know, you've got to kind of think about this long and hard before you make any decisions. You've got to have a plan. You've got to get some professional advice.
Don't delay until you're poor in health, and then you start making decisions that you would have made differently
right.
if you were better off and financially stronger than you might be later down the road.
You know, I mean, that's a good idea for lots of things in your life, not only just when you're getting older, but you know, if you're looking to change careers, it's better to try to get a new job while you have a job. You don't really want to be in that position where you're squeezed. And now we're saying, you know, don't delay, do it while you're healthy, make a good, reasonable decision so you don't have factors forced upon you. That's just smart.
And then think about where you're buying a home. I mean, think about the amenities, the transportation, the access to healthcare. How far are you from shopping? You got to think that maybe you're going to have limited driving.
Doctor's
appointments, you know, all of that should be taken into consideration well in advance.
Good advice from Terry Story. Terry is a regular guest on Real Estate Roundup, and she can be found at terrystory.com. And don't forget that you can hear Terry once again anytime, actually, on our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. Just look for Terry Story in the Real Estate Roundup section, and you'll get to hear her commentary, or you will actually can read the transcript of our discussion. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Do you have enough money to live the life you want to live? Do you have the resources to support you and your loved ones? And how do you know if you'll have enough to retire, or if you retired, how would you know if it will be enough to last the rest of your life? Well, that's exactly what my next roundtable event is going to be about. I'm going to answer these and other questions on Thursday, June 1st. I've even set up two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's Thursday, June 1st at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which one works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Douglas McCormick has gone from active duty Army officer with a young family to the Harvard Business School, to employee at a Wall Street investment bank, to private equity investor and entrepreneur. Douglas answers the question, is financial security achieved through savings tricks and stock picks, or through your key decisions about education, career, and even the lifetime value of your hard-earned labor? He takes a somewhat unconventional but entirely rational view of the vital decisions we face as we guide our lives toward financial success. Welcome, Douglas McCormick.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Douglas, you know, as I said, you have figured out a somewhat unconventional approach to building financial security using the idea of acting as your family's CFO. What is the role of a CFO in a company, and what is the role as you see it for the family?
Yeah, so a little bit of background. You know, I graduated from business school. I was about 30 years old, and I was avidly reading, trying to understand how to make good financial decisions myself. And one of the things I struggled with most was a lack of a framework to help me think through the trade-offs between investments in myself through education or entrepreneurship versus investments in the market and how those things influenced my need for savings or insurance. And so I think the key thing that the book offers is a framework to help to connect all of these different disparate decisions. And it's a framework that's been tried and tested in the business world. And so, you know, if you look to a company CFO, they often do things like manage the income statement and the balance sheet of the company. They do financial planning to forecast how that company is going to do. And they spend a lot of time ensuring that the company has adequate cash flow or access to capital to execute its business plan. And in many ways, the specific actions are different, but all of those concepts are very applicable to how people navigate the financial game of life.
Okay, so those are some very good points and a very good description of what a CFO does for a company. So let's take it right down to the family level, what you call Family Inc., and give us some specific examples of how that would work.
So first of all, the reason I call the book Family Inc. is the analogy is all of us are business owners, and we own our labor and we own our financial capital. And the game is to convert labor into money as quickly and efficiently as possible. So when it becomes time to retire, you can rely on that money. So if that's the business, if you will, then, you know, none of us believe that businesses manage them themselves. They must be actively managed. And a CFO in the family does things like manage the budget. They do things like manage how people are spending their labor. So choices around education, career choices, risk management through insurance, and of course, investing, and then retirement planning.
I want to get into this idea of labor as an asset. We don't think of labor. We think of that you work, you use that money to pay for your life. If you have extra, you try to save, you may try to invest. We don't actually think of labor conventionally as an asset like a stock, a bond, or a piece of real estate. Why do you?
Well, first of all, I believe intellectually it should be. And my best analogy is I think labor is like food, and that if you sell it at the right time, it can be very valuable. But if you don't take care of it and you let it spoil, it just goes to waste. Mm-hmm. And I think it really changes the philosophy about how you spend your time professionally. I think when you think about it as an asset where you're going to gain value from it over many years, it forces you to make decisions that maximize the long-term value of that labor as opposed to decisions that may be good in the short term.
So give me an example of that.
I think education is the best example. You know, there's lots of conversation today about how education is too expensive. It's not a good investment. Mm-hmm. And I would argue it's certainly gotten more expensive, and there are a lot of reasons that are not great about why that is. Having said that, it's still an exceptional investment for someone who has the aptitude to finish and who uses those skills to pursue professional opportunities that require an education. And so if you look at it from an investment perspective, education, it has a better expected return than any asset class out there right now.
I guess that would depend on the kind of degree you're getting and the kind of career you're going for, because not all degrees have the same value.
No doubt. So, you know, one of the things that I always point out when people talk to me about the book, I am not saying that every decision you make should be financially driven. And when it comes to things like career choice, that's a great example where you've got to overlap, you know, your values and your passions with the financial implications. But I think we're doing our young people a huge disservice as they go to pursue college. Arguably, it's the largest investment they will make in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And we're not giving them good tools to evaluate the financial impact of those choices. But just to comment on the impact of those choices, you know, the data is pretty clear. People that pursue educations around math and sciences and, you know, more quantitative oriented fields garner significantly better compensation in the workforce.
I like some of the charts that you used in the book. The book is Family Inc., by the way. My guest is Douglas McCormick, the author, where you plotted out, you said, you know, the beginning of your career, if you look at the value of your future earnings, it comes out to, you know, a pretty large number. I mean, you know, if you're making $50,000 a year, let's say, or $100,000 a year over a 30-year period or a 35-year period, you know, that could be worth $3.5 million or something of that nature. So you've actually plotted that. And really, you also plot a termination point or a terminal point, let's say at age 67, where the value of labor diminishes because you're going to stop working, and now you need your assets to make up the difference. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that chart is the best way to convey this concept that I call Family Inc. It highlights the three assets that a family has over a lifetime: your labor, your savings, which grow over time, hopefully, and then Social Security benefits, which, you know, you could argue not everybody gets, but a very high percentage of us do get. And I think it's an important asset to consider. And, you know, I think for people to see that graphically and be able to see the trade-offs between how to convert that $3.5 million, which is a good estimate for many people, into savings that support them when their business kind of changes, you know, when it comes time to retirement, you have a lot less flexibility on how you're going to achieve financial security. Because, you know, as long as you're working, in my mind, you still have lots of flexibility to overcome, you know, bad things in your life, whether they be market returns or divorces, because you can always choose to work longer and save more. Mm-hmm. But once you get to that retirement point, you have a lot less latitude in how you manage your risk.
Let's talk about risk for a second. Many of my listeners have built up investment portfolios and savings over time. Let's say they're approaching retirement or they're at retirement, and they go to a financial planner, and a financial planner recommends a asset allocation. This asset allocation is generally decided upon as to what kind of rate of return is needed versus, you know, what kind of volatility risk a person can stomach, which I think is a very elemental way of looking at it. We look at things more complicated than that. But my question is that if you take in the type of job that you have, the type of income sources that you have at retirement, for example, if you have a pension or even using Social Security, that should be included in your total asset allocation, because those sources of income act like an asset, like a fixed income or a bond asset. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, and I would actually take it, you know, back a little bit further in that chart that we're talking about. You know, one of the things that I think is relatively different about my approach is, when you include your labor assets and your expected Social Security assets, both of those, in my mind, behave like fixed income. Mm-hmm. And it really implies that we should all have much greater equity exposures, both while working and even while retired, than most people recommend. And I think, you know, we're all conditioned to perceive risk in different ways. Obviously, investment return risk or volatility in that return is one that you read about a lot. I think the two scarier risks are often inflation, and that's arguably not a big risk in today's environment, but over history it has been, and longevity risk. And we all hope to live a very long and full life, but financially that creates, you know, incremental consumption needs. And I believe in general, if you ask me which I'm more comfortable assuming, volatility in return risk or longevity risk, I would much rather take more return risk, because I think we're all going to live longer than mm-hmm. we often expect. And, you know, even when you're retired, when you lay out when you're actually going to consume this money, it's a much longer hold period than most people estimate or appreciate.
Yeah.
So I generally recommend more equity exposure than, I guess, convention.
Yeah, which I thought was really quite interesting and to a very large degree, very accurate. I think it's also, there's a disconnection. We can see what's in front of us, so we can easily understand short-term risk as measured, let's say the S&P goes up and down, Is it gone down a lot? You know, it's perceived as a risk. But these long-term risks are really very hard to grasp, very hard to get your arms around. There's so much uncertainty. It's so ethereal in its nature. So there's this tension between this short-term focus that we all have and really our long-term needs. You want to talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, it's interesting to me that a lot of the way we consume information is simply to make it easily understandable. We look at returns on a daily basis. We look at annual returns and we measure volatility on an annual basis. Arguably, from a practical perspective of how that influences the investor, it's really irrelevant. You know, if your timeline to consume these assets is, you know, more than a year or two out, we should be looking at volatility on multiple year basis and returns on multiple year basis. Mm-hmm. Also, I think returns are, in terms of how it impacts a person, should really be measured on, you know, after tax, after inflation, basically your ability to consume. And so really, when you think about it in that way, you know, I think it's hard to ignore what's happening on a day-to-day basis, but I think through education, we can get people focused on the important risks and teach people to endure the short-term volatility for the benefits of what I expect to be longer-term appreciation. And I guess just one more comment here.
Sure.
I encourage folks to think about themselves like a business owner with their investment portfolio, not an investor. And what I mean by that is, you know, it's easy to get to fall into the trap of feeling like you own the S&P, but you don't own the S&P. You own Walmart, you own Berkshire Hathaway, you own Amazon.
Right.
If you look at those businesses in collection, I mean, their performance in terms of actual earnings growth or earnings stability is really quite good.
We often do this in our office. We open up these index funds and we show what's inside. So, you know, you may have a Vanguard growth fund or a Vanguard value fund or something of that name. And it goes up and down and up and down. You look at your statement and you go, what is this thing? It's going up and down. Oh, it went down a lot. I don't feel so good about this. But when you open it up and you see Disney and you see Home Depot, Berkshire Hathaway, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, the list is long. It helps to ground you in exactly what it is that you own. And also this fact that these companies are worth more today than in aggregate, on average, than they were worth 5 years ago, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And as a shareholder, you are really participating in that wealth creation. Put those all together in a package, put a name on it, and call it an index fund. Vanguard does this, Fidelity does this, iShares does all of this, and so many other funds. And you have this product that seems to bounce up and down every day. But inside that product is something real. That's what you really have to count on. My guest is Douglas McCormick, and the book is Family Inc. You can go to his website too at familyinc.com. And to hear this conversation again, of course, don't forget to come to our website, which is onthemoneyradio.org. I wanted to talk about one other aspect here. We have a few minutes left. People work, and you say this labor has value, this labor has capital, and they put their money in their 401ks. And let's say they put it all in equities because they're 28 years old or 35 years old. So here's one issue that has come up that I think needs to be addressed. In my view, if your job is very economically sensitive, let's say you're in a cyclical industry, right? Versus being a doctor or something that has kind of a steady income, and your savings are cyclically sensitive too. You know, Douglas, what happens when you lose your job and you need to go into your savings at the same time in order to survive? Both are going to be depressed.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we often get confused about the priorities of our, you know, financial assets. And in my view, the number one priority for our financial assets is short-term liquidity to support the family's consumption when your labor business underperforms, if you will. And so, you know, while I'm a big proponent of equity investments, I think the number one thing you got to do is play defense. And the way you play defense is you ensure you have appropriate insurance around disability and life insurance.
Yeah.
And then you have a savings cushion. And I think that depending on, you know, how high your income is, how much you spend, and how hard it will be to replace that income, that saving cushion could be anywhere between 3 and 12 months in my mind. But I think you've got to buy yourself peace of mind and give yourself enough liquidity to make sure that you don't find yourself in financial distress. Mm-hmm. You know, I said earlier, there are a lot of things we can overcome by working longer, saving more. Financial distress, you know, defined as having to default on a loan or have bankruptcy, it's a real tough time overcoming that kind of financial challenge.
My guest, Douglas McCormick, that's a very good book, especially if you want an organized way of thinking about your investments in the totality. Hate to use the word holistic, but it is a holistic approach. The book is Family Inc. The website is familyinc.com. Douglas, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it, Steve. Lots of fun. Thank you.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Life moves very fast these days. The days zip by, and some things are just pushed aside, because let's face it, they have to be. If it's not in your face and doesn't get your attention right away, all of us will put important things off. Except for some of us, especially when it comes to money, those things reappear when our heads hit the pillow at night. So I want to suggest an idea to you. I've decided to put on another roundtable event where I'm going to help you start focusing on the next stage of your life. I'll show you how to figure out if you'll have enough money to retire, or if you're retired, to figure out if it will be enough to last for the rest of your life. Maybe you want to leave some money behind, and maybe you don't, but how do you really know if the decisions you've made so far are adding up the way they should? And how will you know if the decisions you're making today will be the best for you and your family's future? And here's another thought. Wouldn't it be a shame if you had more than enough money to live the rest of your life the way you wanted to, but you didn't live that way because you were afraid of running out of money? Wouldn't it be a shame if you were holding on to your money too tightly out of fear and uncertainty? I'm going to be tackling these and other important topics at my next roundtable event, which will be at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura on Thursday, June 1st. We'll have two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which time works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. So Thursday, June 1st, at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Join me as we take the time to understand what your money truly means to you so you can get back to sleeping well and knowing that you've figured out how to live your one best financial life. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.